construct and energize the transfer pathway. In order to finance this last desperate gamble, Five had been forced to tell Earth's 100 billion at least part of the truth about the totality concept and its hope for human survival. This pacification was necessary because when the power was diverted from food processing, from water and air purification, millions of people had died. Millions who weren't missed by the CEOs, and who were replaced in a matter of hours by screaming, hungry newborns. Millions upon millions more had died when, at the peak of the drain, the power grids browned out, and the populace had gone mad. Recent history had taught them to be afraid of the dark. When the lights went out, bad things happened. Whole neighborhoods got walled in. The trapped multitudes were left to starve or to commit suicide by inhaling carnifages. Lujan suspected that once the transfer of population began, all the gloves would come off. The treaties that held the Five together would be broken. A war would ensue on both sides of the reality passageway for control of the human future. No matter who won, one outcome was certain. Society on Earth, which had been on the verge of consuming itself for decades, would take the final, irreversible plunge to extinction. In his visor, the Major saw yellow figures slowly unrolling plastic sheeting along both sides of the trailer. When that job was complete, the members of his tactical unit used telescoping rods to reach high on the sides of the box and place limpet mines under the slime on its metal skin. The precisely set charges would blow off the trailer's roof and peel back its walls to the floor. As the demolition crew hurried back to the cover of their APCs, Lujan unclipped the remote detonator from his breastplate. Dam would get no warning. Only shock, shock, and more shock. Lujan was about to take his opponents from a place of relative safety and light into the deadliest of darks. A few moments of panic would give him the chance to pull the visitor to safety. He enabled the detonator and put his thumb on the boom button. In the glare of the trailer's overhead lights, the taller of the two female Mercies hunkered down cross-legged on the floor and, right under Ryan's nose, started to field-strip her weapon. He couldn't help but notice the pair of tattoos on her pale, wiry forearms. The one on her left arm said, "Buy or Die, 2034th MLAB." The one on her right, though it wasn't easy to read, said, "Five Forever." Her skin was blurred with furrows of waxy scar tissue. It looked to Ryan as if she had tried to scrape off the green, red, and purple design with a serrated knife. The Mercy reached to the rear of the stock and dropped the wide, curving magazine into the palm of her hand. When she set it to one side on the floor, Ryan got a better look at its top. He saw nothing familiar there. No stacked rounds visible. Just a trio of silver stubs sticking up out of an upraised ring, which made him wonder if the thing wasn't a mag after all. She detached the entire trigger assembly by pulling a pair of small pins on either side of the pistol grip. After putting this encased unit aside, with a hard half-twist, she unscrewed the tri-barrel and forestock, which also came away as a single unit. The removal of two more pins on the receiver below what appeared to be the fire control indicators allowed her to take off the protective housing that sat atop the buttstock. Inside were many mysteries. The female Mercy lifted out a foot-long, flat black cylindrical container that necked down at the end where it joined the barrels. It was connected to and rested upon a nest of thick insulated cables. When this unit was out of the receiver and hanging off to one side, it exposed a clear glass or crystalline block that had fibrous material laced all through it. After detaching the block from the interior of the receiver, she set it in her lap and with clips and wires hooked it up to a palm-sized LCD readout. Satisfied by what she saw, she wiped the ends of the crystal with a swab dipped in a tiny vial of some kind of solvent. She was careful not to touch the areas after she'd cleaned them. Then the Mercy snapped the weapon back together even more quickly than she'd stripped it. Her precise, seemingly automatic movements told Ryan she could have repeated the procedure blindfolded. Dam noted Ryan's interest in the procedure.
"Nothing like that on your world, huh?"
"Just the ones Nara and her friends brought with them."
"I guess the nuke war sort of put a crimp in your R&D. Don't suppose you could have gotten much farther than the neodymium glass laser, which is probably 50 generations removed from what we've got now."
The Merc leader took the rifle from the woman, detached the magazine, and to Ryan's surprise, handed the weapon over to him. It was amazingly light and warm to the touch. No more than 3 pounds without the magazine, he guessed. He shouldered it and found the fit, cheek to stock, very comfortable. The balance was even better. Triple deadly, in fact. Slightly nose-heavy and quick on the point, which was just how Ryan liked his blasters. He looked down the adjustable leaf rear and bladed ramp front sights. There were no dovetail grooves for a scope mount, which surprised him. He turned the rifle over and found a jeweled nub on the underside of the flash hider. It faced the same direction as the muzzle. The backside of the Little Diamond's housing ended in a thin tube that ran along the join of tri-barrels and disappeared into the front end of the buttstock. To Ryan, it looked like part of a laser targeting device of some kind. Up close, he could tell the dark blue barrels weren't made of steel, but of some densely layered polymer fabric set in clear resin. He could see its weave when the light hit the surface just right. He guessed it provided better heat dissipation and longer wear than steel.
"What you've got there is state-of-the-art,"
Sam pointed at the lump of scar tissue on his chin.
"A near miss from a rifle just like that one gave me this beauty mark. Another couple of inches and it would have taken off my head."
"Why two triggers and 3 barrels?
"Front trigger is for single shots. The back one is for bursts and sustained fire, controlled by those selector switches on the side of the receiver."
Ryan checked out the switches. One of them pointed to the white letter S. It could also point to the red letter F. He figured it had to be the safety. The other switch determined the pulse length.
"The tri-barrel configuration focuses individual laser beams a few micromills apart on the target. Get a kind of harmonic chainsaw effect that way. Big-time atomic disruption, which magnifies the temperatures at the point of impact and the beam's cutting power by a factor of 100,000 or so. You've got to make sure of your background when you touch off one of these. The pulses can travel a long, long way before their energy is used up."
Looking at the blaster, Ryan couldn't help but ask himself why Dan was telling him all this. Because he was bored? Perhaps. Because he felt they were on the same wavelength? Fellow outsiders, freebooters, soldiers for hire? Less likely, but could be. Or was it because it didn't matter a piddling rad blast what he showed him? Ryan decided that had to be it. With what lay outside the trailer, Dan knew that he wouldn't grab one of the rifles and try to escape. There was nowhere for him to run. He shouldered the pulse rifle again. It made him think about JB and how much he'd love getting his hands on something like this, which made him wonder for the 100th time if his companions had made it to safety and if he was ever going to see them again. One thing he was pretty sure of, they wouldn't be coming over here to rescue him. He had to assume he was on his own. And whenever the opportunity to get away appeared, if it appeared, he had to be prepared to make the most of it. In the meantime, he had to soak up the information he needed to get back to Deathlands. For starters, that meant learning how to operate the strange weapon he was holding. He glanced up at Dam, who smiled at him. There was nothing sneaky in back of the eyes, no bastard evil intentions hidden behind a grinning mask. Ryan knew he'd probably have to chill the scar-faced Mercy, and possibly Nara, too, if he wanted to escape. He didn't have a problem with that, but there was nothing personal in it. Ryan smiled back. He decided to keep asking questions until the Mercy stopped answering them.
"How many shots is that mag good for?"
"You mean the power cell? It'll fire continuously, sustained beam for 15 minutes without a replacement. That's a lot of single shots and bursts, by the way."
Then the Merc held his hand out. The meaning was obvious. Ryan gave the rifle back to him. Dan passed it and the power cell back to the woman Merc.
"As I understand the early reports, you've got no standing armies worth shit on the other side, no operational aircraft, no laser-proof fortifications. Bombed yourselves back into the Stone Age, more or less."
"More or less?"
Dan looked mighty pleased.
"Then it should be no sweat for 14 combat vets and a couple of APCs to take over a nice chunk of your world."
He turned to Jurassic.
"Nothing over there to hold a candle to us. Just like old times, Nara. What do you say?" we could easily make it 15 vets.
From her seat beside Ryan on the crates, the blonde shrugged.
At least, think about it, Captain. The smart move would be for you to put in with us. You might as well.